Welcome to Sex with Simmery. Frank, occasionally explicit edutainment on the most important topic of all. Sex with Simmery is not intended for children and is not safe for work unless your boss is particularly awesome. See more at sexwithsimmery.com.
Welcome to Sex with Simmery. This is Dr. Timmery, and I am really, really excited to introduce our next guest, Whitney Stroob. How you doing?
Great. Thanks for having me.
I'm excited to have you also because you are here in our studio in South Philly, and you teach in all the way in Newark, and so this worked out really well.
Yeah, definitely. It's great to be here locally.
So you teach in Newark, and you are the author of multiple books related to obscenity, perversion, etc. What's the one that's coming out tomorrow?
Tomorrow, my second book comes out. It's called Obscenity Rules, Roth v. U.S. and the Long Struggle Over Sexual Expression. It's about the 1957 Supreme Court case, Roth v. U.S., which was the case where the Supreme Court laid down the doctrine of obscenity that is really still active today, although it's been modified slightly in the decades since.
So what is obscenity now? Like, what is our standard now?
Well, that's a good question, and one that I think is sort of perpetually in flux. You know, fundamentally, legally, what it would be is material that upsets contemporary community standards and is utterly without redeeming social value. That's how the court sort of has defined it over the years, give or take a little bit of verbal tweaking. What it mostly is hardcore pornography that goes against community norms in some way that's somehow transgressive or goes beyond sort of vanilla heterosexual Jenna James movies with, you know, a man and a woman having sex. That would never be considered obscene anymore.
But previously would have been?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I mean, I think if we watch the evolution of obscenity law, you know, moving into the 1960s, Lady Chatterley's Lover is still obscene because it, you know, uses language like fuck. By the mid 60s, verbal stuff is more or less a free for all. At that point, the battle sort of shifts to naked images, especially naked images of men. There's a lot of battles over gay physique magazines, also full frontal representations of women. By the 70s, though, you know, hardcore porn is sort of the final frontier of obscenity law. And that's pretty much where it stays through the present day with modifications, things like animated images of children and intergenerational sex, which the Supreme Court has included within obscenity law this century.
Can you speak to that a little bit more about, because I remember when that case happened that was about representations of children as opposed to images of actual children. And why that is an important distinction and how that actually plays out.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the legalities of it are you know, rather complicated, but the big picture is pretty simple. I mean, basically, the Supreme Court rules that virtual child porn is included within the criminal obscenity and child porn statutes. And so you don't need actual children involved for it to, you know, constitute a crime. And that's something that, you know, many critics of the court have rather emphatically noted goes very much against the original logic of child porn laws, which go back to the early 80s when the logic was about the victimization of children. So we've sort of wandered away from the actual victimization of children to this sort of pedophilic imagination as something that itself has been criminalized.
So speaking to the pedophilic imagination as a sexologist, because my area of expertise would be more closely to like the treatment side, obviously, than the law side. So there is some contention over whether having pornography that is an outlet for those sort of desires is actually beneficial socially, because then it does not get acted out on actual physical children. But on the other hand, there's always plenty of vehement argument that having that is a primer and it will just start normalizing that idea and it will cascade into affecting real children. Do you have anything to say pertaining to that part of it?
Sure. I mean, you know, I'm an historian and not a social scientist, so I certainly can't resolve that issue. But I think, you know, one way to sort of circumvent an impasse that might result there is, you know, acknowledging that punitive sex laws certainly don't solve the problem. Mm-hmm. You know, I think both sides of that debate, if they're going to be, you know, fair and reasonable about it, would theoretically at least, although not in reality necessarily, apparently, you know, agree that the sort of way that sex laws are enforced today is deeply problematic, you know, that criminalizing people for fantasies without any actual victims is a real problem and results in a sort of, you know, stigmatization and, you know, legal exemption from civil society that doesn't do any good and is, you know, incredibly punitive to the people who are, you know, caught in its web.
The interaction seems to come up for, you know, people who might have an attraction to that kind of pornography, but still would, because pedophilic orientation is really, really challenging to talk about in an honest way. And people might feel an arousal. They might feel a desire. They might masturbate to ideas related to that. They may have absolutely no interest in actually interacting with a child in that way and find it not something that they would ever want to act out on. And that, I think, is far more common than is ever commonly discussed in these these conversations. And so we take the forensic group of worst case scenario folks who rape, maybe even kill children as like the exemplar on which we base laws that apply to everyone. And not to say that I want to encourage behavior that would in any way lead to child porn being created, but just talking about it in a more like calm manner about, can we just like even discuss the fact that this exists, like specifically talking about the you know, animated, especially, like, can we talk about why somebody might want to create this that is not inherently because, you know, they're the reincarnation of Ed Gein, like, you know.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, thinking of it in terms of the sort of outcomes of these laws is also, I think, very effective because, I mean, you know, we see in the last decade, I mean, a man in Iowa, you know, convicted for having Japanese manga cartoons. You know, I don't think anybody ever intended for that to be a consequence of these laws. Or, of course, you know, the teenagers recently caught up in these sexting scandals in which suddenly they're held accountable on child pornography grounds in which they're both the perpetrators and simultaneously the victims. You know, it just sort of shows the dead end that I think, you know, is undergirded by a logic of obscenity law that stretches back, you know, 150 years to the 1870s. And we're still sort of playing out the consequences of some of those decisions that were made then.
I think another one that's coming up a lot now for current cases that I've come across is related to crushing laws, and crushing pertaining to specific live animals. So crushing in general could be anything. Like you could be, you know, use it like someone wearing a high heel and squishing a tube of toothpaste would technically count under that. And so would like squishing a stuffed animal or squishing a bug or squishing a living puppy, etc., would all fall under that umbrella category. But there was recently the case in, I feel like it had to be Florida or Texas. That just seems like the right answer. Do you want to talk about that? You're nodding like you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the crushing laws go back to the 90s, right? Under the Clinton administration when, you know, one of the first sort of internet fetish commodities was this animal crushing video genre of women in high heels crushing live animals. And what winds up happening is that Congress passes a law against it. And the Supreme Court just recently overturned the federal law on free speech grounds because crushing, you know, cannot constitute a distinct exception to the First Amendment. Now, obviously, there are plenty of laws under which this, you know, is an actionable thing. I mean, we can prosecute people for animal cruelty grounds and certainly should. But, you know, again, it's a sort of, as a free speech issue, the whole crushing thing, you know, was rejected by the court and becomes sort of complicated at that level. And I think it's indicative of the ways that many of us, you know, have a sort of understandable revulsion to these things. And yet, legally, the logic through which they play out, it becomes complicated because, you know, it's not a free speech issue. It's an animal cruelty issue. But, you know, Congress likes to sort of push things into that framework of censorship and suppression there.
I think, yeah, this the ambivalence about how to address it comes from the fact that it does encompass so many different things. So, yeah, on the free speech grounds, yeah, you should be able to make a video of yourself doing whatever it is that you do, ostensibly. But the problem is if the content is what is reprehensible, then we address the content. But then conversely, it's totally legal to kill an animal to eat it. So how do you then separate, you know, treating animals as at our disposal sometimes and then not for others? And that's when I am glad that I don't eat a lot of meat.
Yeah. My answer to that would simply be global veganism, which I wholly endorse.
So there we are. Let's talk about Roth specifically. Let's talk about who Samuel Roth was and like what led to this particular battle.
Sure. Samuel Roth is a fascinating character. He was an Austrian Jewish immigrant who came with his parents to the U.S. in the 1890s, grew up in New York on the Lower East Side back when it was still an ethnic working class community, sort of had these aspirations of being a high modernist avant-garde poet, and made a lot of headway there. He managed to get into Columbia University on a scholarship in the 19-teens when it was still a notoriously anti-Semitic school. He found himself running a bookstore down in Greenwich Village and was beginning to publish as a poet. And then in the 1920s, his career went sort of horribly askew. He wound up pirating James Joyce's Ulysses, the modernist novel, which at that point did not have a copyright. U.S. customs officials had held it legally obscene. And so material that's declared obscene in the U.S. doesn't have copyright claim. And so Roth was pirating it, which was legal in terms of copyright, although not legal because, of course, it was obscene. And he wound up basically generating this intense reaction from the international art community in which about 170 people signed a petition against him, that ranging from Ernest Hemingway to Albert Einstein, essentially banishing him from the literary community for pirating this text without paying royalties to James Joyce. Now, to Roth's dying day, he insisted that he had a contract with Joyce, and this was legitimate, but Joyce himself denied it. And basically what wound up is that Roth moved from high art and poetry into publishing smut. And so beginning in the 20s, to make a living, he would publish sort of underground erotic material. And that was pretty lucrative at the time, but also very risky. And so over the course of his life, he was involved with the law repeatedly. He spent about a decade of his life behind bars. He was convicted of obscenity charges multiple times from the 1920s all the way through the 1950s. And during most of this, he wasn't really a particularly prominent figure in the national media landscape. But then during the 1950s, at the height of the Cold War era, during a really significant sort of conservative sexual backlash in the U.S., Roth came back into prominence as a sort of paragon of the evils of pornography. He was called before Congress to testify and sort of crucified by Estes Kefauver, a senator from Tennessee who was trying to make his name as a porn buster. And so Roth wound up being arrested again. And then his case this time went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, where the court was sort of forced to lay down a doctrine of obscenity. And what happened was that Roth lost. The Supreme Court affirmed his conviction, so he had to spend 5 years in federal prison in the late 50s into the early 60s. But the doctrine that they laid down in Roth v. U.S. was pretty liberal, all things considered, within the climate of the era, and sort of led to an increasing liberalization of obscenity law. And so it's the start of the kind of breakdown of the, you know, censorship standards in the U.S. that did lead to a more sexually free culture in many ways, although with a lot of restrictions still in place.
So speaking to Samuel Roth specifically, like as a person, spending that amount of time in jail for something like, and then for him, did that cause him to like dig his heels in more and then take this on as like a personal vendetta? Or
yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think in a lot of ways, Roth didn't begin his publishing career thinking of himself as a free speech crusader or even a particularly political figure. Or, you know, he had politics, but a lot of them had to do with sort of anti-Zionism and socialism early in his career. But yeah, once he became involved with the authorities, he definitely sort of doubled down. I mean, being in prison politicized him, and you know, he began publishing very much as an act of political defiance. He actually, in 1930, he was briefly incarcerated here in Philly, not too far from where we're sitting, actually, at Moyamensing Prison, where the Acme is now located. He did a brief prison stint there. And when he came out, he published a book called Diary of a Smut Hound that purported to be the secret diaries of New York's most prominent porn buster, John Sumner. And so it just parodied him, basically depicting him as a sex-obsessed, neurotic mess. And so from that point on, yeah, I think in Roth's publications, you can definitely see a very political bent toward free speech and sexual liberalization.
And would he be likened to someone like a Larry Flint, or would he be very different?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly, yeah, I think we could make a lot of comparisons there. You know, I mean, he was similarly disreputable, right? I mean, I think today in 2013, Larry Flint has almost sort of become respectable. I think a lot of us have sort of forgotten just how sleazy he was perceived as being in the 70s now that he's been, you know, exposing Republican hypocrites ever since Monica Lewinsky. But yeah, Larry Flint in the 70s, you know, when he was talking about losing his virginity to a chicken on a farm and sort of emphasizing, you know, trashiness and sleaziness, you know, that sort of disrepute certainly is where Roth would have fallen in on the cultural spectrum. I mean, he was not supported by the ACLU early in his career. You know, he was not part of a collective free speech movement. Nobody really wanted to be affiliated with him. And so in that sense, yeah, he was a lowbrow pariah. That's what the scholar Jay Gertzman, who writes about Roth, also calls him.
And the ACLU is another interesting element to bring in. So has the ACLU always been supportive in terms of obscenity, pornography, all of these sort of things? Is that a pretty consistent element of their history?
Not really. I mean, there's some debate over this among historians, exactly what the sexual politics of the ACLU were. I mean, you know, the group begins at the very dawn of the 1920s. It comes out of a pacifist group that opposed World War I. And a lot of its early civil liberties campaigns have to do with freedom of association for labor unions and sort of free speech for unions in the sense of picketing and holding protests, which, you know, are being pretty violently suppressed at that point. It's a backlash period in labor history, certainly. And so the ACLU doesn't have a particularly aggressive sexual rights agenda early on. And well through the 1950s, you know, it's not very vocal in obscenity cases. It's not taking a hardline stance. It's not supporting people like Samuel Roth. It makes case-by-case determinations and only gets involved in obscenity cases if they feel the material is sort of high art or culturally reputable. And at that point, that doesn't even include, say, Henry Miller's Tropic of Cancer, which the National ACLU declines to support into the 1950s.
Interesting, because I remember being in the late 90s, and the ACLU was supporting somebody who had been arrested for, I think, like, his boat flipped over or something, and he just cussed off a storm and got arrested for it. So, like, did not defend Tropic of Cancer, did defend that guy.
Yeah, I mean, there's a really fairly radical shift in the 1960s in the National ACLU. You know, from the mid-60s on, it's going to take a hardline stance on free speech. But up until then, it really doesn't in obscenity and pornography cases, and also other sort of sexuality-related stuff. I mean, in the 50s, the ACLU is certainly not defending gay rights in any meaningful way. And by the late 60s, that'll shift. And so, you know, in some ways, it's very much a deliberate public relations tactic. You know, if you dig through the ACLU papers at Princeton in their archives, which is where they're held, you know, you can see internal board discussions about this. And there's a real fear of being affiliated with things like pornography in the 50s when there's this national backlash going on. And so, yeah, I mean, it's a group with, you know, something of a mixed, a problematic history. You know, I mean, certainly other historians of the ACLU point out, you know, it's not stepping in during Japanese internment during World War II. It's sort of kowtowing to the federal government in terms of purging communists from its board in the 1940s. And so, you know, I'd say pornography falls into that realm where the ACLU just, you know, is not quite willing yet or able yet to take a hardline stance. You know, that being said, I would certainly compliment all of that by, you know, very much just affirming that it is the preeminent civil rights group of the last 100 years, and, you know, no group has a better record than the ACLU. I don't want to come off as sort of a, you know, griping critic of the organization.
Then you have to whip it out of your wallet and be like, yes. Yes, I am. Going back to the Supreme Court specifically, I'd like to just hear your take on the infamous "I know it when I see it" sort of idea. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, sure. That's Justice Potter Stewart writing in 1964 in the case Jacob Ellis v. Ohio. Stewart, at that point, was a recently appointed member of the court about 6 years earlier by Dwight Eisenhower, and he hadn't been a very prominent participant in the obscenity debates. It's kind of ironic. I mean, that phrase comes out of a concurrence that he writes, so it's not actually you know, legally binding. He's not writing for a court majority. He's just sort of throwing his hands up in the air, and it just sort of sticks. It's not intended that way. Much later in his life, he sort of muses wryly that, you know, among all of the accomplishments he's had and all of the court opinions he's written, that's what he's going to be remembered for, which is sort of a bummer in many ways, because Potter Stewart, well, sort of a complicated and problematic justice, did certainly have his much finer moments than that. But I think it becomes a symbolic moment where, you know, we see the legal system just sort of cracking down and throwing its hands up in the air and admitting the futility of obscenity law. You know, I mean, this is a Supreme Court justice, you know, who's supposed to be interpreting the Constitution with clarity and, you know, decisiveness, basically acknowledging, look, I can't figure out an algorithm or, you know, an actual strict legal code to deal with this. You know, porn comes to the court and I recognize it, but to codify that in law is just impossible. And I think that's why, you know, it's such a remembered phrase, even though it's never binding precedent.
Because this speaks to the human experience with pornography. And I show different types of videos, for instance, to when I'm training future sexuality educators. And we show stuff that is not supposed to be the most extreme. It's not necessarily like the most crazy example of BDSM ever, or, you know, the most exaggerated whatever type of porn it is. And it's impossible to have a unanimous reaction to anything. And this is a fairly, it's diverse in a lot of different ways. Everybody's coming from different places in these rooms where I'm showing these videos, but they're still somewhat homogenous in that they are sex positive enough that they came to a program to be sex educators. And even among that group, you don't get unanimity about what is past a hard line and what is gross and what is arousing. So, like, how could anybody ever come up with a standard?
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree completely. You know, when I have taught classes on the politics of porn, you know, very sort of similar chaos has ensued. And yeah, I mean, in some ways that is kind of the argument I make in the book, that the Supreme Court has just really never been able to effectively deal with this, partly because, you know, obscenity doctrine just doesn't work. You know, censorship has never been effective really anywhere without an authoritarian government sort of mandating it through force. And even then, it's not effective. And so to try to sort of come up with a coherent legal regime that would, you know, interpret this through the Constitution without acknowledging that incoherence, I think has been really something of a disaster.
What is your suggestion? Like, looking at what has happened, what do you think would be more utilitarian?
Well, I mean, it's a good question. You know, frankly, I think probably I would say that some of the opinions by William Brennan and William O. Douglas in the 1970s came as close to an effective policy as we've ever seen legally. You know, there's something interesting here and ironic. William O. Douglas and Hugo Black are mostly remembered for being the most libertarian members of the court when it comes to free speech. They basically didn't believe in obscenity doctrine at all. But William Brennan, a justice from New Jersey who gets appointed to the court in the 50s and becomes the preeminent architect of obscenity doctrine, he writes Roth v. U.S. in 1957, you know, and attempts to come up with a legal standard that would end the debate. Now, he fails completely, of course. It doesn't end the debate. But by 1973, he's actually voting to overturn his own precedent because he's decided that it is futile. And basically the standards he arrives at are that if material is not sort of aggressively harassing people who don't want to see it in the public arena, and it's not being targeted toward children, and it's not guilty of pandering, which is to say sort of sending, you know, unsolicited mail to people who don't want it, then everything should be legal under the First Amendment. And so he becomes sort of a First Amendment sort of extremist in that sense. But by that point, President Nixon has appointed a whole new court majority who's taking a more conservative tack. And so instead of becoming the new doctrine of obscenity, Brennan's writing in dissent against his own doctrine, one of the many, you know, sort of not particularly funny, but ironic moments in the history of obscenity. And I don't think, you know, any justice on the court has articulated a better framework than that, frankly. I think, you know, they've all been failures, essentially. I mean, they've all wound up having unintended consequences of either, you know, targeting LGBT expression, which may not have been unintended, to be clear, but is, you know, certainly very problematic, or they've, you know, wound up in these debacles that we were talking about earlier with virtual child pornography or sexting. You know, I mean, these are the inevitable consequences of obscenity law as we know it, I think.
So there is a completely different court now, obviously, than in any of these times we've discussed thus far. What is the tenor, what is the general feeling that's going on towards obscenity-related things on the current makeup?
Well, I mean, we haven't had a major obscenity case in quite some time now. I mean, probably the last major case that we had would have been around 2002 involving the virtual child porn. Around 2005, a federal justice in Pennsylvania, actually in a case called Extreme Associates, tried to invalidate the federal obscenity law by citing Lawrence v. Texas, the 2003 case that had recently decriminalized consensual adult sex and overturned sodomy laws. He suggested that the implications of Lawrence were that the federal obscenity law was also invalid, but he was overturned by the Federal Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court chose not to engage with the case, so it became, you know, that overturning stood. And there hasn't been a really prominent obscenity case since then. You know, what we see is that under the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, we definitely see a much more aggressive Justice Department in pursuing adult obscenity cases. But what they really do is target really fringe material, you know, simulated rape movies, scat porn, stuff that's really beyond the mainstream that, you know, you're not going to see the corporate porn industry really defending. And so it stays really under the media radar. And what they do is target people in sort of conservative districts like Utah or Montana and hit them with shotgun charges where they face 95 years in prison, knowing full well that people will, you know, plea out, you know, plead guilty for reduced sentences. And so none of that leads to any major court battle. And then under, of course, President Obama, we see really a de-escalation of that. I mean, President Obama has not pursued adult obscenity cases. And of course, Attorney General Holder, when he's appointed, draws a whole bunch of flack from the conservative Christian right because he once was an attorney for Playboy. And so, you know, obscenity just has not been a really prominent legal issue at the Supreme Court level for quite some years now, even though clearly it, you know, continues to circulate and have really material implications in people's lives.
So have we come to a place of sort of stability on this issue? That probably not going to be any major fluctuation?
I would say that, I mean, clearly there's not going to be any major federal prosecutions under Obama or any other Democrats. But I mean, if you remember the election season in 2012, every single Republican candidate pledged to prosecute adult obscenity cases again, from, you know, our own beloved Rick Santorum here in Pennsylvania through Mitt Romney.
Yeah,
a very popular figure on this show, I'm sure. And so, you know, I think it's very, very likely that, our, you know, if we see another Republican president, we will see a resumption of obscenity cases. And, you know, certainly that'll play out in the legal arena in ways that, you know, I think could be quite frightening to free speech. We have a very conservative court right now. Obviously, Justice Scalia is a sort of strange conservative in that he does have a free speech bent. But, you know, the gravitational pull of the court has been to the right. And I have a very hard time imagining, you know, some new sexually liberatory obscenity case coming out of the Supreme Court anytime in the foreseeable future.
And I'm also just curious, like, what technology is going to emerge that we then have to address this? Like, and obviously sexting was a good example because, like, you're a 15-year-old kid and you take a picture of your body and you send it to your 17 or 14-year-old partner or whomever, and, like, okay, now I gotta figure out how to do with that. But, like, something is gonna come that we haven't thought of yet. And then, like, what comes to my mind is, like, something with teledildonics. I don't know. I don't know where this is gonna go. Do you have, like, any random guesses? Like, you just
oh,
wanna
Lord.
We'll just throw out on the table. Like,
boy, I don't know. This is kind of the luxury of being an historian, right? I get to look backwards rather than forwards. No, I truly don't know. In fact, I must sheepishly confess, I'm not even sure what teledildonics are.
Then I should definitely explain what
you
that is, because that's the point of the show. Okay. So teledildonics has to do with the sexual activity that can be done, like, over the internet. So some of that could be, like, you wear a device and somebody else is wearing a device, and then the movement that you create is experienced by the other user. Or it could be that a user just controls via, you know, like handheld control, what a sex toy is doing to a wearer. It can manifest in a lot of different ways. And it's definitely like really good step for long distance relationships or somebody who has to travel a lot and you can still maintain that level of intimacy. Obviously, this can be combined with other things like Skype or, you know, something else where you have like that visual component to it. Or you can, you know, this is sort of an extension of just like the panty vibrator where somebody else is holding the wireless remote, you know? So, and it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Distances mean less and less. And I'm, you know, just very curious how that will somehow have a downside.
Yeah. I mean, technology is always outrunning the law, and then the law is sort of desperately reaching after it and trying to grab it within its confines, right? You know, that's certainly what we've seen with the internet ever since the mid-90s. And, you know, under obscenity law, you know, internet transmission was considered a thing because they didn't have another way of conceptualizing it. You know, even though there's no physical object, they just decided to legally render these files physically objects to make them legally legible. So my guess is, yeah, that the law will in some desperate way chase after this technology and try to absorb it into the existing kind of structures of meaning, even if that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, because I'm like trying to conceptualize, so obviously something's gonna go wrong. Like, because people are creative, if nothing else. So, you know, in terms of teledildonics, like the potential of like unwanted sexual contact, I guess, would be really the only thing that comes to my mind.
Well, and certainly, I mean, age of consent issues in in an semi-anonymous internet world.
That's a really good point. So what if you meet in a chat room or some sort of situation like that, and the person to whom you're speaking says that they are a legal adult, and it turns out that they are not, and you have just fingered them via the internet. Like, do you go to jail for that?
I would assume not if it came up as an explicit point of discussion, but, you know, certainly there are prosecutors who would chase that, right? I mean, it probably depends where you are geographically to some extent.
And this also goes to, like, the Dateline whole To Catch a Predator. Like, I have a whole lot of feels about the show because the whole thing is, let's talk about child porn. Let's regale and bathe in the discussions of what conversations they had with this person about sex with a kid, even though everybody involved is an adult, because it's always, it's actually entrapment, in my opinion, a legal adult pretending to be a child, presenting an opportunity to talk about sex with an adult. And then they have an explicit conversation and we all get to watch and we all get to like bathe in that and enjoy the lurid nature of it. And then we realize this is an incredibly bad thing and we feel a lot of, you know, like anger towards someone who would exploit a child. And so we all get to have the money shot moment of getting to bust the dude. So it's still like the same narrative as a porn. And we never at any point ask the question, so real life though, a 13-year-old kid does do that. Why? What is of interest to the 13-year-old kid? What information are they trying to get? What kind of experience are they looking for? What about actually talking to 13-year-old kids about sex? What about that? And like the whole thing is just horrible, yet that's the prevailing narrative. Ugh!
Yeah, well, I can't do as effective a grunt, but my sentiments exactly.
I'm just throwing things.
Yeah, no, I mean, truly, it's a voyeuristic spectacle, right? I mean, turning a complicated situation of, you know, imbalanced power relations and child sexual curiosity into this simplistic narrative of good, evil, and, you know, spectacle, right? Yeah, it's problematic, I agree.
And I also want to talk about is this your first book, The Perversion for Profit?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's my first book.
That's so awesome. No, so this has to do with more of like a general trend rather than like the specific case like Roth does. Can you, so Perversion for Profit, The Politics of Pornography and the Rise of the New Right. What is this largely about?
Yeah, so this is my first book. It came out a couple of years ago in hardcover. I don't think many people except libraries buy hardcover anymore, but it just came out in paperback last month. And I mean, this is really about the ways that the modern conservative movement that, you know, we often label the new right used pornography as an issue to sort of mobilize a new sort of political support, you know, one that shifted from some of the older political issues of, you know, support for the Cold War, opposition to the Black Civil Rights Movement, you know, that became much less tenable in the late 60s. And so we see conservatives sort of regrouping around this whole set of moral issues. And I think part of my argument is that pornography sort of leads the charge, that we see this discourse of perversion cultivated around pornography. And then that plays out, you know, in very similar lines against feminism, against gay rights, when it comes to abortion issues, the Equal Rights Amendment. And so, you know, pornography is sort of a gateway, I argue, to a new moral agenda for modern conservatism. And I think the flip side of that is that part of my narrative is about that sort of failure of modern liberalism. You know, while conservatives are doing this, we don't see liberals providing a strong dissenting voice, you know, something that would offer a sexually progressive or inclusive agenda. We see liberals, you know, sort of really complicit in the emergence of what, you know, gets labeled in the 1980s as the, quote, family values agenda, in which the family is essentially, you know, a married, heterosexual, procreative unit. And so I think, you know, the implications for this are pretty profound and really still with us today in the ways that liberals are very squeamish about sexual politics.
Why is that? Why is there no attempt to stand up to this? Because I feel like in discussing sexuality issues with adults, like if you can actually all be discussing it as adults, assuming they're not specifically fringe or incredibly reaction formation-y to sexual issues, I feel like most adults are actually not nearly as prude as our politics indicate. What is that?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And I agree. I mean, there's, you know, a huge disconnect between popular sentiment and American politics today, right? I mean, on a multitude of issues from healthcare to sexuality, right? I mean, Americans want healthcare, but our government doesn't seem responsive. And I think sexuality is similar, although it's got its own unique lineage in that one of the things I try to argue and show is that it is actually liberals who are leading the charge on some of these reactionary sexual politics in the 1950s. And so in a lot of ways, the modern conservative agenda grows out of 1950s liberalism. You know, if you look at the people leading the charge against pornography in the 1950s, it is liberals. You know, likewise, the ongoing panic over, you know, queer Americans working for the federal government. I mean, it's liberal governments that are, you know, maintaining that and upholding it in the 50s and 60s. And so in a lot of ways, what happens is that liberals find themselves pushed against a wall in the 1960s. They've cultivated, you know, a fairly deeply reactionary sexual politics. And suddenly the right mobilizes around it in a more extreme variant. But liberals have never really cultivated, you know, sexual pluralism or diversity as a value. And so they don't have anywhere to go. I mean, I think the way that you see liberals going is toward abstraction. And so instead of defending sexual expression or, you know, gay rights, talking about individual private freedoms, you know, instead of defending abortion, you know, defending women's right to choose while being very squeamish about abortion. And I think, you know, liberals have never found the way out of that sort of trap. You know, even today, you know, you're never going to hear President Obama vigorously affirming a woman's right to choose an abortion on demand financed by the federal government the way you would have 40 years ago. You know, and you're not going to hear Obama talking about queer rights. You'll hear him talking about absorbing LGBT Americans into normative institutions like marriage. You won't hear him defending, you know, pornography or, you know, queer porn. You'll hear him talking about free speech. And so that's really given the right, I think, a whole lot of ground to exploit and claim that as, you know, their turf, that they are the ones who have a moral agenda.
And that moral agenda is seeming to be largely dictated specifically by religious beliefs too. This isn't scientific. This isn't based on, you know, sociologist work that this kind of content has this particular outcome. This is not at all an empirically based thing that we can even have a rational, like, no, but like this actually, you know, da 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 da. You're nodding like you know, yeah, you go.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, I guess there's a variety of ways to address that. But I think you know, if you look at 1970, when the original President's Commission on Obscenity and Pornography issues its report, you know, this is a group of social scientists primarily who are appointed by Lyndon Johnson in the late 60s, and they issue 10 volumes of social science research and a report basically arguing for the decriminalization of obscenity on the grounds that it doesn't have any demonstrable socially ill effects. You know, most of the narratives about porn at that point are that it perverts children and it leads to juvenile delinquency and sexual deviance, which is a very nebulously defined term, and they refute all of that. And conservatives at that point are very up in arms. Richard Nixon, who's president, declares it moral anarchy and rejects the report completely. In fact, the report says we should decriminalize obscenity. Richard Nixon says we should use this moment to make it even more restricted. And what happens is that, you know, it's another moment where liberals don't raise a counter voice. What happens is there's a Republican backlash to the report, and the Democrats are basically just completely acquiescent in that. They don't speak out. They join in the Senate in condemning the report and rejecting it. And it, you know, it doesn't have any material consequence. You know, it's been, you know, a few million dollars, a few years of research, and the report just sinks like a stone. And then 15 years later, Ronald Reagan appoints a new porn commission through Attorney General Ed Meese that's specifically intended to revoke the earlier porn commission. Now, this time, I think we do see modern conservatives who are certainly, you know, employing religious values here. I mean, this is an evangelically Christian movement to a large extent. In the 80s, under the Meese Commission, they try to adopt the trappings of social science. And so they use a lot of social science rhetoric, you know, to ground their preordained conclusions about porn and its corrupting effects. But it doesn't really work very well either, especially because the social scientists they're citing are alive and vocal and denounce them. So for instance, Edward Donnerstein, who's a social scientist at the University of Wisconsin at that point, they cite him showing that pornography leads to violence and sex crimes. And Donnerstein speaks out against them, saying, no, they've misused my research. That's not at all what it says. What it suggests is that sexually violent representations do have a mental impact on viewers, you know, in laboratory settings, but that if we isolate the sex and the violence, it's actually the violence that has the you know, demonstrably negative impact. If we watch nonviolent porn or Friday the 13th movies, which are huge in the 80s, you know, it's the slasher movies that actually replicate that effect, not the porn. And so, you know, he argues this is not about porn. And the Meese Commission, you know, it fails to a large extent. The media makes fun of it in 1986. But I think it does show the ways that, you know, there is this sort of cultivation and co-optation of social science rhetoric that does stick with us today. So I certainly agree with your point. You know, this is not an empirically founded movement, but it's become increasingly sophisticated at, you know, adopting the language of social science. And so today we have, you know, a whole panoply of semi-academic looking journals that publish, you know, ostensible research showing the ill effects of porn, you know, usually not particularly credible in a conventional, you know, sense of being peer reviewed by objective outsiders, but, you know, carrying that sort of veneer, you know, and so there's a lot of citations now that can support, you know, an anti-porn agenda, although actual social scientists are sort of perpetually frustrated by this, I think.
And this speaks to two really significant problems. One is the use of like one individual scientist, like who might just for whatever reason, maybe they like the attention, maybe they're just particularly passionate about something, like the fake link between like abortion and breast cancer,
right,
or, you know, supposedly all the evidence about how vaccines lead to autism, like all of these sort of things. If you just feel like incredibly strongly behind something, you don't need to actually examine, well, one scientist says this, but like a lot of them say the exact opposite, and we're pretending that this is about science, and there's an actual method with science. I don't know why we're ignoring that. And also to the sex versus violence piece, if the idea is of the right to be, if the outcome is desirable that we don't want violence, if the outcome is we don't want rape, we don't want all these negative effects that we're saying that porn has, why not latch onto the violence thing? Why not turn the sights towards that? That doesn't, I don't understand the continued fixation on the porn if we're like, in agreement that we don't want murder and rape. What is that about?
Yeah, I mean, and again, I completely agree with you. I guess I would suggest that sex sells as a political mobilizing tool, right? You know, anti-violence crusades are much more complicated in that they really would of necessity sort of, you know, lead to this broader media critique that, you know, is nuanced and complicated, whereas rallying against porn, I think, has a much more, you know, simple and proven track record as a political device.
Okay. Well, we've talked a lot about varied cerebral things, and I want to change gears entirely and just ask you why this is of interest to you and why you studied this area specifically.
Oh, sure. I think people who write about porn generally do get that question, probably, which is fair. And I don't know. I don't know that I have a great answer. I mean, you know, I grew up in the 1980s and early 90s. I grew up in rural Alaska, in lovely scenic Wasilla, actually, right before Sarah Palin took over. And, you know, as a kid, I watched these debates play out without any particularly profound understanding of them, right? All I knew was, you know, there was this angry-looking man, Jerry Falwell, and he didn't want Penthouse magazines in the 7-Elevens, right? But you know, it was intriguing to me. I wondered, you know, why is this guy so angry and why does this matter so much? At the same time, I was sort of a movie geek kid reading Joe Bob Briggs, the cult movie writer who would always make fun of the Christian right. And I think, you know, a lot of that probably laid a groundwork, you know, sort of a pre-intellectual groundwork for just sort of engagement with these issues. And then later in college, you know, reading anti-porn feminists like Andrea Dworkin and Catherine McKinnon, and trying to reconcile, you know, being an ardent supporter of feminism with, you know, having a lot of qualms about some of the categorical assertions they were making about porn, you know, sort of kept me intellectually engaged with it. And when I got to grad school for history, I mean, I began writing a dissertation on railroad regulation in the progressive era. And, you know, as the you know, dry look on your face suggests, that's not the most exciting topic, which I you know, learned the
apologies.
Hard way.
Apologies. I was like, what?
No, I mean, I...
Like, you have to spend so much time with your dissertation, and oh my God, you would be like, what?
Well, that was basically it. I mean, I was staring down a future of, you know, reading reports by the Railroad Commission of California from 1913 and decided that probably was not the most fulfilling life. And then, you know, I sort of began to realize, you know, as a history grad student looking at what scholars had done, I mean, there's a lot written about pornography, but no historian had yet really written the story of the sexual politics of debates over this from the 50s through the early 21st century. You know, it seemed like a sort of terrain that I could claim and that I'd, you know, long been sort of engaged with and interested in. And so I just kind of jumped in. I mean, my original vision of my dissertation was actually specifically about the feminist sex wars, but then it just sort of grew outward from there into being about larger political mobilizations on the right, which I think, you know, certainly is involved with the feminist anti-porn movement in the 80s in a really complicated way. And so that's kind of the backstory, I guess, to how I wound up, you know, writing two books about obscenity and smut.
So do you consider yourself an activist? Do you consider your work to be a work of activism?
Well, I don't know. I mean, activist is such a loaded, fraught word, right? I don't know that that's the immediate way I'd frame it. I mean, I certainly don't claim to be a neutral observer. You know, I'm probably guilty of actually being somewhat overly polemical at times in the books because I make very clear. I mean, I think obscenity law has been, you know, a sort of catastrophic failure. I certainly think that the new right and modern conservatism have been disastrous for America and devastating to people in terms of sexual rights, ranging from, you know, abortion to free speech to LGBT rights. So, I mean, you know, I'm not a disinterested observer. I think, you know, I wouldn't frame it as a work of activism. I mean, I think it is a work of scholarship that, you know, is based on archival research and, you know, careful scrutiny of the documents. But yeah, I mean, I've got a strong point of view that I think comes through and that, you know, is very clear and that I'm happy to publicly align myself with.
Well, I'm glad that you exist because I think that this conversation needs to have like pro-sex people, sex positive people in every facet of it. Because obviously there's the ivory tower element to it that limits the how widely this stuff can be talked about. And we need satirists, we need celebrities to do talking about it. We need everybody to counter, because we certainly obviously can't count on existing political figures, as you've repeatedly mentioned. So I'm glad that you're doing this. So I want to just give another couple shout outs to your books. So you've got the first one, Perversion for Profit, and it just came out in paperback.
Yeah, yeah.
And then tomorrow, well, as of when we're recording this, so this might be a crazy time travel episode, but then also you've got Obscenity Rules coming out. So where can people find these books? Where can they find out more about you and about the other historical work that you do?
Well, I guess a variety of places. I mean, it breaks my heart that I can't really say independent bookstores everywhere, because they're dying off at a tragic rate. I mean, here in Philly, I guess we have Barnes & Noble, but, you know, we've also got Wooden Shoe Books, the anarchist bookstore on South Street. I have no idea whether they have these, but certainly they could order them. On the other hand, I mean, for sheer, you know, convenience, albeit catering to the corporate overlords, you know, they're on Amazon. You know, we're trapped in this ambivalent relationship, right, where you can't help but rely on Amazon, even as it takes this, you know, kind of unseemly monopoly over current literature and books. So, yeah, those are places. I mean, I teach at Rutgers Newark. My CV and articles that I write and things are, you know, up on my faculty webpage there, which I guess you could just Google, because to tell you the truth, I don't have the URL in my head. And then lately I've taken up blogging, figuring, you know, like you say, breaking out of the ivory tower is really, I think, both imperative and frankly fun. So I've been blogging on WordPress, not a particularly professional looking site. I think it's, what is it? Strublog, I decided. Strublog at dot WordPress.
Oh,
dot,
that's a nice little snow globe.
Yeah, yeah. It's cheesy as hell, but, you know, the B, I couldn't help but pivot on the B. So, yeah, those are some places where I guess if people are interested, they could check things out.
I dig it. Well, I am I'm super glad that these exist.
Thank you.
And for my upcoming students, you may be required to buy these books and read them for class. Just going to let you know that. So again, Whitney Stroop, thank you so much for coming today. This has been fantastic. Any takeaway messages you want to definitely, like, if it wasn't already clear, I think we're on the same page for sex positivism, but like a particularly interesting point you want to leave people with?
Well, that's a lot of pressure, but I would say...
say the most interesting thing you've
well,
said.
I would say, you know, that the debates over pornography and obscenity are deeply interwoven with much larger questions of sexual citizenship. And so, I mean, I see this as part and parcel of a much larger social debate over, you know, people's rights to their own bodies and sex lives and identities. And so, yeah, that's what I would say, that this is, you know, inseparable from, you know, women's rights and LGBT rights, even if porn is a much more complicated topic that doesn't lend itself quite so easily to a pro or con kind of bifurcated positioning.
I cannot echo that statement enough, because, like, really it comes down to if someone can control your sexuality, if someone can control your own body and how you relate to your own body and the thoughts that you have in your head about it, there's literally nothing that they can't control. And
yeah,
so,
absolutely.
Yeah, just totally echoing that sentiment. This is important, not only interesting because we like porn and we want to be able to get our porn easily,
right,
but also just about, like, who's in charge of you and did you actually sign a master-slave contract, you know, that sort of thing. So again, thank you so much, Whitney Stroop, and thank you everyone for listening. Go get the books and have a great day.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to Sex with Timmery. Sex with Timmery, the podcast, is produced by Nathan Karuna. Our opening music is by Charles Evans. Our closing music is by Hanya Lee. Be sure to check out sexwithtimmery.com, Sex with Timmery on Facebook, and tweet at me, Timmery_LEIGH. If you're a fan of the show, if you like it at all, a little bit maybe even, rate and review us on iTunes and tell your friends all about it. And thank you.